Hey, it is so good to have a chance to be here with you tonight and this week. I'm so grateful for the invitation. If the Lord crosses our paths again, I'll be happy with it. Last night, we talked about what is a Baptist, and we listed six key defining doctrines, that are very important to us. All those doctrines today are under attack. They're even under attack in what used to be Baptist circles, and that may still carry the name on their door. But you ask yourself a question as you begin to try and come to grips with this. So many different churches. All these churches have a starting time, a starting place, and a founder. Okay? As you might have guessed, Martin Luther founded the Lutheran Church, 1500s. John Wesley founded the Methodist Church, 1700s. John Calvin founded the Presbyterian Church, 1500s. You can go on and on and on, group after group after group. But then you get to the Baptists, say, well, who in the world founded the Baptists? And you can't find a human founder. Now, I know it's very common today to say, well, Baptists were part of the group of Protestants that came out of the Catholic Church in the 1500s. This is just absolutely not true. And for several reasons it's not true. There have always been, there's record in every century since the first church of Jerusalem of churches that believed the things that we have listed last night. Throughout the centuries, they get called by different names. We'll talk about some of them tonight. But churches that believe those truths have always been there. They never affiliated with Rome. They never answered to the Pope. There were churches that came out of Catholicism in the 1500s. Baptists were not one of them. They already existed and existed all through the ages. We don't have a human founder, don't have a human headquarters. And when we debate over the founding date, people are debating, was it when the church was started in Matthew chapter 16, or where the church really began to function on the day of Pentecost, or when was that? We don't have anything like the rest of those churches do. We are not the same thing. We are not Protestants. We've been there throughout the entire New Testament era. There are always, in every century, churches, and I go through that in the book Faithful Baptist Witness. There are always that in every century. There are churches that believe these truths that if they existed today, we would call them Baptist. And as I point out in that book, there are secular historians that get this. Not because they share our beliefs. Robert Lane Fox, who wrote a book called Pagans and Christians and the tension for 300 years between the pagan culture and the Christian culture, he said there were always groups along the Tigris and Euphrates River that if they existed today would be called Baptist because that was their doctrine. They weren't the only ones. But if you'll go with me to Matthew chapter 22, I'm going to give a brief lesson of a couple of important points in our Baptist heritage. We mentioned last night the Baptist distinctives. One we did not talk about very much was separation of church and state. But in terms of our history, this is the most important one. Throughout history, there's been an incredible amount of persecution of Baptists and other Christians. A lot of folks are tempted to think that we've been persecuted because we preach the gospel. The truth is, very rarely is the persecution because we preach the gospel. Most dictators, evil empires, and so forth don't care much about what you say about how people get to heaven. Now, that in the Muslim empires, there has been persecution over the preaching of the gospel. But even Hitler said, you tell men anything you want to about how they go to heaven. I'll tell them how to live here. The issue in persecution has usually been the separation of church and state, not what Baptist churches taught about how men could go to heaven, but what they taught about the church being obedient to men here in this day and age. And if you look at this, this is, again, not a new debate. It goes to the time of Christ. And we pick up in Matthew chapter 22 and verse 18. But Jesus perceived their wickedness and said, why tempt ye me, ye hypocrites? Show me the tribute money. And they brought him a penny. He said to them, whose is this image and superscription? They say to him, Caesar's. There then saith he unto them, render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and unto God the things which are God's. When they heard these words, they marveled and left him and went their way. Now, most of the time when this is quoted, it's quoted by somebody who's preaching obedience to government. He says, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Some things do belong to government. and government should be followed and obeyed when it's in its proper sphere of authority. But rarely is the statement ever finished. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, but render unto God the things that are God's. Some things don't belong to Caesar. And that is where the issues that generate persecution have come in throughout the years. For example, I have had the privilege of preaching in Syria back in 2005. I don't know any other non-Syrian preacher that has preached in Syria. And it was a great opportunity. It was very hard to get a visa to go there. I got one, and not long after that, the Civil War broke out, and it wasn't safe to go back. I had a 10-year visa, but only went once. And when you got there, boy, here was the thing. There are only two legal churches in Syria. Roman Catholic and Greek Orthodox. And to be legal in Syria, the government has some restrictions. To be legal in Syria, you have to tell your people that Muhammad was a great prophet of God. So the Roman Catholic Church made an agreement to do that. The Greek Orthodox Church made an agreement to do that. The Baptists don't make an agreement to do that. And number one, we don't make agreements like that. Government is not in charge, and it's a lie, and we wouldn't tell people that. And the problem to have to make Baptists not legal there is that they wouldn't accept being told by the government what they were going to teach their people. See, some things belong to Caesar. Understand that civil government has the right to make laws in certain areas. Some things belong to government, but some things don't belong to government. Some things belong directly to God. And can I say this? Your children belong directly to God. Okay? Your children, whose image are your children in? Here was the illustration in front of them. And they're discussing taxation. And Jesus said, bring me a coin. They brought him a coin. He said, whose image is on the coin? Caesar's. Do you know who it is that ought to coin money and print money? That belongs to the government. I'm really glad all of our Baptist churches aren't printing their own money. We'd have the biggest economic disaster you could ever possibly have imagined. That belongs to civil government. Civil government has some legitimate expenses. Seem to have an awful lot that aren't legitimate, but to have some legitimate expenses, provide for the common defense and so forth. And so the concept of taxation is a legitimate biblical one. Some things, including some of our money, legitimately belong to Caesar. But our children don't belong to Caesar. If the illustration, whose image is on your children? There's two possible answers to that. One, image of God. Your children belong to God. You know what the other answer to that is? You. Sometimes you're utterly amazed when you look at children and you see how much like their parents they look. Whose image is on the church? The church is the body of Christ. The church doesn't belong to Caesar. The church belongs to God. And the teaching in this passage is, well, yes, there are some things that belong to the government. There are some things that belong to God. And that's where throughout the centuries, we are independent Bible-believing churches that teach the Baptist distinctives have had trouble with government because they want to believe that everything belongs to them. The concept of it. And throughout the centuries, that's what the big issue would be fought over and what the battle would be fought over. You find it in the New Testament era. You find the persecution beginning, first of all, the Jews in Palestine persecuting the church, but the Roman Empire persecuting the church. And the Roman Empire, during the first 300 years of church history, the Roman Empire persecuted Christians in general. 10 major persecutions, 10 different times the army was told to gear up, go after the Christians. Sometimes they were told to kill all the Christians, but not always. But they were always told to kill all the pastors all 10 times and to burn all the church buildings and to burn all the Bibles. 300 years of nonstop persecution. By the way, that proves to you right away there was separation of church and state. There was something different. after 300 years and Christianity grows and grows, people get one to Christ and Christianity spreads and grows, that finally a deal is reached to let the Christians become part of the state, become part of Caesar, and many of the Christians and many of the churches agreed. By the way, it's easy to be critical of them, and they were wrong. They had been through 300 years of nonstop persecution. The first council that met to negotiate all that, more than 50% of the preachers there had already been crippled for life in tortures from the state. And they were willing to take a deal to become part of the state and end the persecution. It's easy to be critical of them. I'd like to believe we wouldn't do that. But none of us here have ever faced what they faced and been put in the situation they were put in. But immediately, when the state began to take over the churches, there were churches that said, no, we cannot do that. It's contrary to the teaching of the Bible. And throughout the centuries, these churches were called by different names in different places. It was like every area had its own name for independent churches. You have to understand back then that there was not much communication between the different parts of the world. So churches would get called by the name of a prominent person that preached these truths. Or they get called by the name of a city where they flourished. Or they would get called by some particular truth that they emphasized. And it wasn't until much later that began to become a name, and we'll talk about that as we go on. But what happened in these early days, when the state church is first forming, there were some men that stood up. A man named Montanus, a man named Donatus, a man named Novatius, and they preached that the Bible taught independent churches accountable to God alone. And so the people that followed them in that doctrine began to be called by their names. Montanus, Donatus, Novatians. And you find record of them all over the place. The idea that everybody was Roman Catholic, very frankly, is a myth that was started by the Catholic Church. There were many groups. There were our Bible-believing Baptistic churches, but there are also a lot of other groups. There were a huge number of groups that never belonged to the Catholic Church. The idea that everybody was once Catholic is absolute myth. You go through a generation where those are the churches. You move on, and as Christianity spreads, you begin to be known by all kinds of different names throughout North Africa, throughout the Mideast, throughout modern-day Europe. Sometimes they'd be known by a region. The Waldenses. The Waldenses will tell you, they go back to the time of Paul. They were found in northern Italy and southern France. And they believe the Apostle Paul himself came and founded the first Waldensian church, whether he did or not. By the 300s, there are many historical records to the Waldenses being in north Italy and southern France. They were independent churches. I have a chapter on them in the book. And there are many, many other groups that come up. They get known by a place or by a person. In the Mideast, they were often called Paulicians. And some historians have tried to argue who were the Paulicians named after. But it's real clear where the Paulicians got their name. They kept quoting the Apostle Paul whenever it came to discussing the nature of the church. They quoted Paul so much, people called them Paulicians. You want to know why they quoted Paul so much? All the teaching about local New Testament church was given by God through Paul. And so if you're going to discuss what the church has to be like, you're constantly going to Paul. They got called by a variety of things, by a variety of names, a variety of people, a variety of towns, but there were always people that preached all of these doctrines that we talked about and called the Baptist distinctives. A doctrinal book of the Waldenses has been discovered. It is called The Key of Truth. I'm sorry, Doctrinal Book of the Paulicians has been discovered. It was called The Key of Truth. It lists every one of these doctrines. There are Waldensian churches that still exist today and trace their lineage a long way back. Some of them came to the United States back in the early 1900s and started a city of Valdez in North Carolina. They also started a town in New York. You can go to Valdez today and find a memorial to them and to their history that is really worth looking at. These independent churches were everywhere, and God used them. One of the popes, the most powerful pope that ever lived, called Pope Innocent III, name one very appropriate, but he was a very powerful person.
Pope Innocent III issued decrees and said that every king in Europe had to obey him. And he said, if you don't obey me, I'll issue a decree that sends everybody in your kingdom to hell for eternity. 85 times he threatened to do that to kings, and kings gave in all 85 times. That's power. But Pope Innocent III wrote that half of the Christians in Europe belonged to independent churches that had nothing to do with Roman Catholicism. They were there. They're all over the place. They show up in all over the Middle East, all over Northern Africa, and all over Europe, and you see God's hand on them. People paid for these beliefs with their life. They got crucified. They got burned at the stake. They got fed to wild animals. They got beheaded. They got drowned. All over the place, people paid for these truths because they believed them, they were committed to them, they would not abandon them, and they stayed faithful to them, and they stayed loyal to them. By the way, we're really spoiled here in the United States. I will tell you, there are places around the world today where all of that still exists, and people routinely risk their life in order to be faithful servants of the Lord. I saw things the 7 days that I was in Syria that were unimaginable outside of church history. I had the chance to go there, and there's one independent Baptist church above ground that was not hidden in Syria. The reason it existed there is because Secretary of State Jim Baker, one day, this is back during the first Gulf War, was sitting on an airplane next to the pastor of that church. And they got to talking, and he told him he was a Baptist pastor and told him about his church, and he told him about the persecution they were going through. And Secretary Baker was on his way to Damascus to meet with the dictator Assad, father of the current dictator Assad. At that time, Syria was our ally in the first war against Iraq. And Arab tradition, you walk in to see an Arab person, the Arab has to greet you this way. What can I do for you? You must tell me something I can do for you. And so Assad greeted Secretary of State Baker with that. What can I do? You must tell me something I can do for you. Tell me anything I can do for you and I will do it. And Secretary Baker said, there's a church in Latakia that your people are persecuting. He said, if you want to honor me, stop the persecution of that church. And Assad did. He was not persecuted again until after he was dead and in the height of the Civil War. This is a couple of years ago. They got to come out when all the other churches were underground, build a building. I got to preach in it for a week. Build a building, have a sign, and be open. But man, and I got to go there. It took me 3 years to get a visa, but I got to go there and preach for a week. It was an amazing experience. I had two security guards from Assad security police with me all the time, or supposed to be. And the truth is, the church would often give them bribes and they would go away, come back 12 hours later. I asked them one time, said, how do you know which security police you can bribe and which ones you can't? And they looked at me and laughed. The thought of a security policeman you couldn't bribe. And I mean, I watched them. They'd give them $150. There'd be two of them. They'd give them $150 American each, and they'd disappear for 12 hours. Walking along one day, and they told me the guards were for my protection, and that was partially true. They were also there to, you know, keep an eye on what I was doing and what I was preaching and so forth. But I was walking along one day, and we only paid the guards to go away when we were having services and things. And some guy came up to me, got right in my face, began to yell and scream at me in Arabic, nose to nose. And I didn't know what he was saying, but I got the idea. Found out later he was saying, you're an infidel. How dare you walk down my street? I'm going to cut your head off. And the two security policemen pulled out their badges and their pistols and walked up to him, because the security police can kill people. They have a license to kill people. They don't have to count anybody. And as soon as they spoke to that guy and he saw their guns and their badges, he just backed away, apologizing. It's interesting. The whole part of it was interesting. I saw people there, faithful Christians there, that did things every single day that you and I would think we were heroes if we ever did once. We smuggled Bibles into Turkey that were on their way to Iran. We had a baptism And it's against the law to baptize adults. We're Baptists, only baptize adults. And they had 19 people that had been waiting, some of them for years, to be baptized. And they rented a bus. And we were going to take the bus to the Mediterranean Sea and have a baptism. And the Mediterranean Sea has strong currents. And so we had four people to baptize, one holding each leg and one holding each arm. They had the pastor, they had a deacon, an evangelist, and as the guest, I was the fourth person. We pulled up on the estate of the dictator's mother, which is right next to the dictator's estate. And they're both on the Mediterranean Sea. We pulled up in a bus in front of a bunch of guards carrying Kalashnikov rifles. Walked out into the sea, baptized the folks, came back out, got on the bus and left. And I said to my interpreter, "How did we get away with this?" He said, "We read in the newspaper that Mrs. Assad is out of the country. And we knew that they wouldn't do anything without checking with her first. And it's the middle of the night where she's at, and we knew they wouldn't call her and wake her in the middle of the night. And so I said, thank you for not telling me this before we did the baptism. And they just looked at me and said, the best place to hide from a camel is under the camel's nose. I mean, these folks did things every day that you and I couldn't imagine. We're spoiled Americans. We don't know how this works. But this is an unusual moment and experience in history. Most of the folks who believe what we believe paid for it by enduring constant, never-ending persecution. They have a place in England known as Lollard's Tower. That was where they hung Independent Baptists. People who believe the Baptist distinctives, people who believe the separation of church and state would only baptize adults. That's where they hung them. It's a memorial to this day. What happened? It's real simple. They believed in rendering unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, but they also believed in rendering unto God that which was God's. Over and over again, they'd be called by somebody's name. There's a fellow named Arnold of Brescia. He preached that the Pope had no right to rule over true churches. So he organized a group of folks in a rebellion, and they went to Rome and they ran the Pope out and declared everybody free. And for a while, there was freedom for all the churches. But eventually, the Pope put an army together and came back. And they captured Arnold and burned him at the stake. Over and over and over again. It was over this principle. Separation of church and state. By the way, it's my experience that politicians aren't all that crazy about that today. In my years in ministry, I've heard more than one politician quote the first half of that statement, render Caesar the things that are Caesar's. I've never heard one of them speak the second half of that statement, and unto God the things that are God's. And I've been in battles over that where I've had to help them finish that statement. We have had a history of people who are willing to pay the price in order to stand for these precious truths. You know what irritates me today? I mean, the United States was founded on the concept of separation of church and state. All the founders weren't Baptists, but they got the idea from the Baptists and the influence of the Baptists. Over and over again, in the colonies, there was persecution, but there were Baptists that were heroes. In Virginia, when Patrick Henry was famous as a lawyer in Virginia, there were laws that said you couldn't be anything but Church of England. And there were three Baptists that were being prosecuted for not having a license from the Church of England to be preachers, and they were preaching, and they were on trial, and Patrick Henry shows up after the trial started. He, along with George Washington, probably two most famous men in the colony of Virginia, Patrick Henry shows up and volunteers to be their lawyer. He's accepted. He gets up. He says, "What are these men here accused of today?" And then he starts talking about all the trouble on the border, all the out-of-control border ruffians, all the time and money and energy that needs to be spent to protect the border towns. And he said, "What are we doing here today? We're prosecuting these men." He said, "Why are we prosecuting them?" "For preaching the gospel of the Son of God." That's what we're using our time and energy and emotion and money on. And then he goes around the room again, waving the sheet of papers that are their indictments. And he says, "What are we doing here today?" And he talked about all the Indian trouble on the border, the raids and the difficulty and the need to build forts and strengthen the border. But he said, what are we doing here today? We're prosecuting these three men. What are they accused of? Preaching the gospel of the Son of God. He walks around the room again, waving the papers. Comes back, says, what are we doing here today? Here we are in a depth of trouble, dealing with the agents of Mother England. Problem on every hand. It demands our attention, our time, our energy. But he said, what are we doing here today? He said, we're prosecuting these three men. And what are they accused of? Preaching the gospel of the Son of God. The jury acquitted them on the grounds the law was unjust. All through the colonies, these things existed. In Massachusetts, there's a man named Isaac Bacchus who pastored the same church for 60 years. Besides pastoring a local church, he devoted himself to helping churches being persecuted. He traveled all over the colonies whenever a church was in a persecution. And with the blessing of his church, they gave up the time of their pastor who would go spend weeks with them when they were dealing with and fighting and battling the persecution. This went on during the whole colonial period. When we won our independence and we were debating constitutional government, there was a considerable debate about the Constitution that we now cherish. It was unsure whether it would pass or not. The Baptists were not supporting it because it did not mention freedom of religion. And it was so close in the state of Virginia, and it looked like Virginia would just carry the day one way or the other. And nobody really knew how the vote would go. George Washington was campaigning for it. Patrick Henry was campaigning against it. And James Madison went to the Baptists and said, we need your help. And they said, we can't support it because it doesn't mention freedom of religion. And he said, I give you my word that if you'll help us pass the Constitution, I will devote my life to making the very first amendment to the Constitution freedom of religion. And they believed him. Imagine believing a politician. The Baptists supported it. It passed narrowly, and James Madison devoted the next several months to getting an amendment to it that guaranteed freedom of religion. How about that? A politician kept a promise. And they did. And they put up a statue in Virginia to a Baptist preacher named John Leland because he's the one that persuaded the Baptists to support the Constitution. And then they honored James Madison because he's the one that promised to campaign for religious liberty after the Constitution was passed. And he kept his promise, even though he wasn't a Baptist. He kept his promise. And out of it came a government committed to separation of church and state. And no longer was there any persecution for believing these truths. And that country flourished and grew and became powerful and strong. Its economy boomed. Its population boomed. And a factor in that, I won't say the only one, but a factor in that was the people of the country had been persuaded of the Baptist distinctive of separation of church and state. That had not been an easy battle. In Switzerland, which is where we first began to carry the name Baptist, in the 1500s, the country got divided between the Catholics and the Calvinists. Both groups, we weren't Protestants, both groups prescribed the death penalty for Baptists. The Catholics said if you're caught being a Baptist preacher in their part of Switzerland, you would be burned at the stake. The Protestants said if you got caught being a Baptist preacher in their part of Switzerland, you would be drowned. One of them said they wish to immerse so much, we will immerse them. And they made a penalty for drowning. They took entire congregations like this one, men, women, and children, chained them together, forced them at spear point into rivers and lakes until the entire church family drowned together. In 1526, in Little Switzerland, in 1 year, they drowned 25,000 Baptists. People paid a price. In England, Baptists were persecuted and persecuted, but they again were the great defenders of religious liberty. They had the penalty of being burned at the stake for being a Baptist in England. When King James, of King James Version fame, first became king, one of the first duties he had to attend to was serving as the regent at the burning of two Baptist preachers. And after he saw what happened, he said, never again. I will never let this happen in my kingdom again. And he ended the practice of executing Baptist preachers. He gets blamed because there were two burned while he was king, and it is the truth, and it would have been nice if he'd ended it sooner, but it's also true that King James is the one who ended the practice of burning Baptist preachers. And as time went on, the Baptist became more and more prominent and more well-known, and the level of persecution of them began to be limited and limited and limited until finally they became free. John Bunyan, Pilgrim's Progress, was a Baptist preacher in the 1600s. In his time, they were no longer burning people at the stake, but you could go to prison for 6 years for preaching a sermon without a license from the Church of England. John Bunyan got arrested for preaching in a Baptist church, sentenced to 6 years in prison, served it, got out, and the next Sunday he preached in a Baptist church. Got arrested, sentenced, spent 6 years in prison, and the next Sunday when he got out, he preached in a Baptist church. Got arrested, got convicted, sentenced to 6 years, put back in prison, but he had been in prison 6 months when the law was changed. And they no longer imprisoned people for preaching. So he only served 6 months of the third sentence. I mean, what bothers me? We have a heritage of godly, faithful people that stood for these truths and were used of God, and they paid the price standing for the truth. They wanted their children to know the truth. They wanted to honor God with the truth. They handed us our country and our culture and its freedom. And we live with it every day, the blessings of it. And in our day, see, these truths are entrusted to people. But people are temporary. So they get entrusted to people who have to entrust the next generation with those truths, which have to entrust the next generation with them. Guess who's entrusted with them now? It's not John Bunyan. Guess who's entrusted with these truths now? We are. And in our day and age, people are fleeing the identification with these truths. They don't want the name. They don't want the pressure. They don't want the responsibility. And they give in to pressure from the state, right and left. In our day, we're surrendering far too often the precious heritage that the Lord has given us. Folks say, where'd the name come from? Some folks say John the Baptist, and it is true, God used John the Baptist to introduce one of the doctrines that became Baptist distinctives. But they went centuries without being called by his name. Switzerland, 1500s. When the laws were passed persecuting the independent churches that had begun up in the mountains, had been there for who knows how long, they were coming down. At the time Roman Catholicism was being overthrown, they were allies of the Protestants in defeating the Catholic armies. But when the Catholic armies were defeated in some places, the Protestants turned on them just like the Catholics had. And the Protestants would call them Anabaptist. Anna means re or again. They said, you baptize people twice. Here they are baptized as babies. Then you baptize them again. You're Anabaptist. You're rebaptizers. And they begin to answer that cry. We're not Anabaptists. We're Baptist. We don't baptize people twice. The truth is you never baptize them once. Sprinkling a baby is non-baptism. They said, we don't baptize people twice. We baptize them once. After they've trusted Christ as their Savior, they were standing for a precious Baptist distinctive. And so their answer was, not Anabaptist, Baptist. That's during the time right after the invention of the printing press. And you really begin to have communication, people from one country to another. And people begin to write up the story of the cry, not Anabaptist, Baptist, and the story went all over Europe, and people then began to call, instead of having lots of different names, they began to call everybody that stood for these truths Baptist. And ever since the 1500s, the people believe these truths have been called Baptist. The Syrian preacher I was telling you about, pastor, he had been the president of the Communist Party in Syria. I know him. He's stayed in my home. We're precious friends. Don't get to see each other often, but credible man. And he was the head of the Communist Party in Syria. When Assad was putting his government together, he needed to strengthen it. So he went and made a deal with the communists and said, if you'll come in and be part of my government, I'll make the head of the Communist Party the oil minister, which is an important position. So he made him an oil minister. The thing was, he didn't know anything about oil wells. So they went and got an engineer from England to come and spend a couple years with him. That engineer from England was a Christian man. He witnessed to him and left him a Bible when his term was done and he went back to England. And this man who was the oil minister read the Bible and read the Bible and read the Bible. And finally the truth of it broke through and he got saved. And he began to have Bible study in his home for his family. And as he studied the Bible independently without knowing anything about the name or Baptist heritage, he came to believe in every one of the doctrines we call the Baptist distinctives just from taking a Bible literally. Started a church. Years later, he found out about Baptists and what they believed and said, that must be what I am. Because he was preaching all those truths. Still is, still there. And they started a lot of churches. Many of their churches been through horrible time during the Civil War. Some of them were burnt by ISIS. Some of their people were killed by ISIS. And there's a lot I could say about that. Some of their people are still missing. There's a lot of confusion about who's up in the mountains and who isn't. When I was there, I had my picture taken with 12 different preachers besides him. Spent time with them. I was in a meeting with them. And they were discussing how they figured that every one of them would eventually be killed for their faith in Syria. But they were debating the best way, whether they should all come out in the open at once in the same time and all be killed at the same time, or come out one, and then when that one's gone, another one come out, and when that one's gone, another one come out. And so they were debating the best way to die. I'm sitting in a living room with them, and it's all being translated from Arabic into English for me. Finally, after they debated with them for a while, one of them looked at me and said, Brother Stringer, what do you think? And my answer was, I don't think there's a preacher in America that should be giving you guys advice on how to serve the Lord. Not long after that, one of them, their churches would be in their homes. One of them was preaching in his living room, and in the middle of a Sunday morning service, one of the militants shot through his window and killed him in the middle of a sermon. Since then, we know that ISIS killed one of them. Know where two of them are, and the rest are missing. That does not mean they're dead. In the confusion of the Civil War, there's a lot of folks up in the mountains. We just don't know. And everything is not settled yet enough for them to come down out of the mountains if they're there. We're hoping that some, maybe all of the others are alive. We just don't know. But Baptists have paid that price. And now in America, we've gotten too lazy to go through a little bit of persecution. Too backward to stand for these basic truths. Too embarrassed. God help us that this is a host of problem. I'm telling you, we have a heritage of people who in every century, including this one, we have a heritage of people who've been willing to pay the price to stand for these truths and be blessed and used of God. Would you go with me to 2 Timothy? I want to address another truth. I'm sorry, 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 15 that deeply relates to our Baptist heritage. First Timothy chapter 3 and verse 15. But if I tarry long, that thou mayest know how thou oughtest to behave thyself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of the truth. Are you ready? If you get this, it is profound. It is life-changing. If you don't, there's a price to pay. I understand the heritage of this church. I would say this to any church that claims to believe the Baptist distinctives. Right? The church, the local church, is the pillar and ground of the truth. That is where the truth is preserved in local churches. Anytime you build an organization that has a structure of any kind for churches, some of them are much worse than others, anytime you build a structure, to maintain a structure, there's politics. Somebody has to hold offices. Somebody has to lead. Somebody has to get things done. Anytime you do that, there's an authority besides the local church. It is the local church that is the pillar and ground of the truth. To the degree, some organizations have a lot more of it than others. I use the example of the American Baptist Convention, which has a whole host of it. You have a superstructure, an agency, a denomination, a headquarters, a fellowship, association. There's a degree of politics. And then the Bible is not the only authority. Politics is what destroys the truth of Scripture. The local church is what protects the truth of Scripture. And so the story, the history, the heritage. Baptist groups start. They're faithful to God. They develop a human infrastructure and become organized together, and eventually heresy gets in. The structure protects heresy, and the groups go heretical. Often it's confusing reading about them. Read today about the Paulicians, and the Paulicians became a very heretical group. But for about the first 800 to 1,000 years of their existence, they believed and practiced the Baptist distinctives. They became heretical down the road when they developed superstructure. And the superstructure always ends up protecting heresy. American Baptist Convention, an incredible force for God at one time in the United States. It was designed to promote missions around the world. For a period of time, it was very effective. It was designed to start churches all over the frontier. For a period of time, it was very effective in doing that. It would eventually develop an organization, a headquarters, a superstructure to it. And modernism came in. First in the seminaries, but as the seminaries trained preachers to be modernists, then in the churches. In late 1920s, a preacher in Grand Rapids, Michigan said, wait a minute. So we have people who don't believe the inspiration of the Bible teaching our seminaries. How could this be right? And he led the first church out of the American Baptist Convention. I somewhat know the story of the second church that came out, because that fellow would eventually found a Bible college that would be the Bible college that I attended. He sat down, he was in his 80s at the time, but he sat down with me and told me the whole story firsthand from having been involved. His name was Ford Porter. And he became aware of this debate, and he said, surely it can't be true that there are modernists teaching our seminaries. Well, their headquarters at that time, still is, was Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, but they had a seminary there then. He drove from Indiana out to Valley Forge, sat in seminary classes, heard a professor teach the Bible was not the Word of God, wrote it down, got up, went into the denominational office and said, did you know that we have a professor in our seminary that teaches the Bible is not the Word of God? They said, Brother Porter, calm down and relax. It's just one. And his response is one more than I will accept. Went home, led his church to vote, and they voted themselves out of the convention. Convention said, no, you can't leave. Now, see, that is the law and the rule among United Methodists, among Episcopalians, among Lutherans. The denomination has the final say. But they never put that in law for Baptist. And this got fought in the courts and fought, went all the way to the United States Supreme Court. Can a Baptist church leave the convention if it chooses? The Supreme Court assigned some law clerks to study this. Law clerks came back and said, by definition, Baptist distinctives, a Baptist church is independent and you cannot make it belong to anything it doesn't want to belong to. So the Supreme Court ruled that church could leave the American Baptist Convention. that legal precedent opened the door by which thousands of churches left the American Baptist Convention in the 30s, and by which churches years later would leave the Southern Baptist Convention and the Progressive Baptist Convention, etc. Because the definition of a Baptist was the Baptist distinctives, and one of the Baptist distinctives is that a church is independent. It is always the local church that is the pillar and ground of the truth. It is when you get something besides the local church. Today, American Baptist Convention headquarters, like I said, Valley Forge, today, American Baptist Convention headquarters is close there. It's in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Now you might know, Hershey, Pennsylvania is famous for the Hershey Chocolate Factory. And they give about a 4-hour tour at the Hershey Chocolate Factory. And they give a tour at American Baptist Convention headquarters. And I went one day and took both tours. On the same day, I toured American Baptist Convention headquarters and the Hershey Chocolate Factory. One of the two was a deeply moving spiritual experience. The Chocolate Factory. In the convention, everything was a defense of modernism and how they'd grown beyond the inspiration of the Bible, and they now didn't judge people by the way you baptize folks, and they have abandoned every single Baptist distinctive. They had abandoned every fundamental of the faith for modernism. I really did enjoy the Chocolate Factory a lot more. It's the local church. The local church is the pillar and ground of the truth. It is hard to take a local church into heresy if that local church is completely independent. But if you have any kind of political organization, you can be absolutely guaranteed that someday it will be drug into heresy. We're not just seeing it in conventions. We're seeing it in fellowships. We're seeing it in associations. Wherever there's a political organization, sooner or later, the organization will defend its own people when they're wrong. Every generation gets handed these truths to protect once again. I will have to tell you, our generation hasn't been doing a very good job protecting them. When I first went into ministry 40 some years ago, I tell everybody I started in ministry when I was 3, but for 40 some years ago in ministry, there were many, many more churches that held to these truths than there are now. Among the various groups that classified themselves as independent, you couldn't find a modernistic church. American Baptist Convention was gone. There was a modernist element in the Southern Baptist Convention, but the majority of Southern Baptist Convention preachers, when I started, still held all these truths. All across the board, the numbers are far less than they used to be in terms of churches standing for the truth. But it's still our job, number one, to stand. It's our job to teach and prepare the next generation to be able to stand for these truths. It is our job to maintain the heritage, not just because it's tradition, but because it's Bible. It's our job to maintain that heritage and communicate it to the next generation. That is the job God has given to us. God bless y'all. Pastor.